Join Aubrey Masango, evenings on 702.
12 minutes after 10 o'clock, and welcome to this hour of the show. Isaac Potgieter is my guest, PhD candidate and virtual reality developer. Isaac, thank you so much for joining us. I really, really appreciate your time. So, Fire Town, why?
Thank you for having me, firstly. It's a pleasure. You know, this work's been done through the University of Johannesburg, through FARA, the Department of Multimedia and the Metaverse Research Unit. So we started with this work in 2021. There was a grant put out at UJ to do something in VR in Johannesburg, and all kinds of ideas came up. And I think we eventually realized that we thought about how is this not just going to be a gimmick when you work in VR? And it made sense that you're going to be using this technology to try and show people something that they cannot currently access, a place which no longer physically exists. And from those conversations, initially they were at the University of Lab with Denver Hendricks and Khalees and Shona. We settled on Sophia Town. We then approached the Trevor Huddleston Center, which is Sophia Town's main museum, actually an NGO. They do terrific work there. And unbeknownst to us, they've been looking for something similar to this since 2018. So we had the concept that's worked out, the grant money from UJ, they had the need, and it just kind of matched up from there.
Sure. And what is it that you wanted to explore and say about Sophia Town, and in a way about South Africa, its past, its present, and its future?
So I think I appreciated your little intro on all the highlights of Sophia Town, right? We've got the GANs, we've got all of these different kinds of things. That's what comes to mind. So we wanted to take a step back from all of that and actually just not make up or think of what comes to mind, what are the kind of ideas that have percolated through society as Sophia Town has been in our collective imaginations for so long. So we've had interviews with multiple former residents, quite a few of them, who lived in Sophia Town before its demolition, a range from some of them were already in their 90s to their early 70s, so experiences where they were children in Sophia Town to adults. And it was interesting because none of them have actually been interviewed before. So that was a contribution we could make. But the point was, we wanted to just get their daily lives. We just wanted to talk about their memories. And if you remember something for 70 years, it's important, right? Mm. So we wanted to brush all of that aside, go straight to the source, and just figure out what we can actually learn, what we can find out, and just present these stories that we were told directly in an immersive way through virtual reality. That's kind of been the intention, and I think the novel contribution of this to the museum specifically and to the dialogue.
The story of Sophia Town has been told in so many different ways, and a lot of it in ways that are reminiscent of a romantic time. You know, Sophia Town evokes an urban romanticism about South Africa, because many and by the way, there have been many Sophia Towns. You think of District 6, you think of Marabastad in the area there where I come from, Pretoria side, Riverside, and many other places that were melting pots of urbanization during a time of economic extraction, and the culture that became those areas, the vibrancy of it, the music, just the culture is often told in very, very romantic terms. But there were realities, I imagine, Isaac, that that ground that romanticism sometimes, yeah.
You see, I think you brought up two very interesting points there. The first is that Sophia Town was in a way an archetype. It looked different in every city, but it existed, this kind of situation existed throughout South Africa. Where I grew up in Mpumalanga, I did this project sifting through the archives. I found this old document last taken out in 2006, and there was this whole neighborhood close to the CBD in the town where I lived, which was also demolished to create a golf course of all things to create that separation. No one knows about that. No one knows about that where I come from or talks about that. So it really is something that happened everywhere. And then in terms of this kind of romanticization, you are so right on that. And it's interesting because if you read Trevor Huddleston's book, and Trevor Huddleston was the pastor who basically looked over Sophia Town and was an anti-apartheid activist in that capacity, he wrote a lot about how he was fighting for people to see value in Sophia Town, especially from the apartheid government side, obviously. So there was a dominant view of it not being of value. And that's kind of flipped now to being one that's highly romanticized. And the question is, you know, is that also really the reality of it? So by going to the residents themselves and just having them talk about what they remember, we asked very loose questions. We actually tried to ask as few questions as possible, and they mostly just spoke.
Yeah.
They talk about good things. They talk about bad things. They talk about complicated things. They brought it all up in such a nuanced way. And that's what we really wanted to present, that as Don Matera said, which was really a kind of foundational point of this, no one can really tell the story of Sophia Town, you know, least of all me. So if we can just talk to a few people and have them present their memories and represent that, we can kind of, I'm hoping that we can kind of just access a little bit of the complexity of how nuanced it was, how it was not a slum. It was not a romantic urban setting. It was something kind of in between and all over at the same time, and just more complicated than that. And we're hoping that people can engage a bit on that kind of level, where it gets to that level of nuance.
I suppose it is apt that the University of Johannesburg, which many people say is really located geographically in Sophiatown, be the ones that tell the story?
Indeed. I think there's literally Sophiatown residencies, there are student centers in Sophiatown, there's a relationship with the museum, students go there, a lot of students actually live in Sophiatown because it's so close to the university. So that kind of osmosis, I suppose it does make sense. And there is a history there.
Sure.
And so you had the university's 4IR push, which I think has been much publicized.
And the medium that you've used, virtual reality platforms, modern technology, just in terms of reach, is it able to tell the story as granularly as perhaps the story of Sophia Town demands?
I think what's interesting about this technology, firstly, you go to the museum, you go on these walking tours right now. And the museum is self-funded, so these tours are a big part of their income. And you go through, you know, what stands there today. And most of Sophia Town, of course, was demolished. Two homes exist, one which is in disrepair, the old church, and a boundary wall. That's the extent of it in this place where, you know, which was called the Chicago of South Africa. You go through and essentially they tell you what used to be there. There's a little flip file showing you. And I don't know how effective that is, especially with youth groups and especially with the youth, because they cater to a lot of youth groups and school groups and university groups coming. But the idea is that with this, you can put it on and first see what actually used to be there and just the size and the grandeur of it, and then go out on these tours. So that's the one thing, being able to bring back something which physically no longer exists, or at least represent it. You can't bring it back. On the other hand, you're able to bring in so many different medias all at once. You've got audio playing of the residents talking about what they see. You've got the actual environment that they're talking about. You've got the background sounds. You've got effects. You've got all these different kind of layers. And then also it's something that takes up all of your vision. So especially for younger audiences, there's literally nothing to distract you because there's nowhere else to go.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think with the kind of people that visit the museum, the youth has definitely been a target for them. And this has got a lot of excitement around it. We've exhibited at the Arts Festival a few times now. And I can tell you the kids and the youth especially stand in line for this kind of thing because it's so novel. And it just leaves this impression that's very hard to misunderstand. If you see it and you're in that street, it's hard for your brain to not understand what this film looked like. You know, where it was a photo or a video, you might not be paying attention as well.
Give us a call, 011-883-0702, if you were a resident of the Sophia Town. Maybe you are a resident of contemporaries, Sophia Town. And I would imagine Auckland Park, you know, the whole precinct that the University of Johannesburg is at would probably be associated with the Sophia Town of that time. I'd love to hear from people who lived in Sophia Town back then. If you can give us a call, would love to hear. What are your memories? What are your thoughts? What is the untold story of Sophia Town, do you think? And then perhaps those of you who now live in that area, do you understand? Do you know where you live? Do you understand where you live? What is the story that you are telling about Sophia Town wanting to say, Isaac?
Look, it's not really my story to tell. And it's also something that I've come with kind of a blank slate in many ways. And we quickly realized that we need to speak to people who actually lived there. And I can read as much as I want. I can, you know, do as much research as I want. I will still have an inadequate picture of what it was like. It is just too far removed from my own experience. And it's not about me at the end of the day either. So I think we were very open to just hearing what we get from the former residents we interviewed and just trying to present that without altering it too much. And like I said, it's interesting because it touches on topics of the romantics of our time. It touches on topics of, you know, the more difficult side of it. It touches on aspects of the demolition. It touches on aspects of all kinds of different things, mundane things, difficult things, because this is just people relaying their stories. And these things naturally feature, even though they're somewhat in the background of their stories. So for me, there was nothing specific that I at all have to say about this. But we were just open to trying to get the former residents to tell their stories and to translate that into this medium as best we could,
Give me a sense of the time period that we are looking at.
We focus specifically on the time before the demolition, but because we're telling life stories here, people who live there, it often goes over that time period as well and into their stories beyond that.
And this would have been when? Give me a sort of circa date.
1955 around. But there was around a 15-year gap between the youngest and the oldest person we've interviewed. So we have that experience from a little bit further back and a little bit more in the recent present. But around 1960 at the latest, 1955.
When does Sophia Town become established? I mean, and what were the circumstances in the establishment of this settlement, of this strange settlement? We'll go into that strangeness at some point. When does Sophia Town begin?
You know, Sophia Town was formed by a series of extremely specific and seemingly unlikely events. So in 1896, there was a Jewish man named Thomas, what was his name, Tobiansky. And he established this neighborhood. He wanted to make money. He started selling it out to mostly poor Afrikaners at that time. And then the city decided to build a sewage works next door, which immediately reduced the amount of interest in his new neighborhood. So out of that, he kind of started opening it up to everyone. And this was before the Group Areas Act. So people that weren't white were actually allowed to buy property and own property. And then when the Group Areas Act came a decade or so later, there was already this group of non-white people who now own property and are able to build wealth and are able to study and become doctors and lawyers and all these different kinds of things. So that emerged. And then as apartheid continued and more white-only areas were established, of Sophia Town being this kind of island, eventually everyone in the city that needed to be close to the city that wasn't white went to Sophia Town, and it became this incredible, dense melting pot where you had mansions with backyard dwellings in the back. You had rich people sharing their property with people who were essentially living on the street because they had nowhere else to go. And it was just squeezed into this very compact kind of space that had to hold up all of this whole side of Johannesburg that just didn't want to be there, that the government just didn't want around, until eventually even that got pushed out. So a very specific set of events. And I think a timeline which kind of encapsulates and sums up things that happen all over the country in one extreme kind of environment.
And again, that's where you see the absurdity of apartheid, right? That it was very, very clear about what it wanted to do, and that is to stop the natural evolution of humanity in that sense.
Absolutely. You know, I think there's this film that was shot in Sophia Town. It was done in secret in 1959, Come Back Africa. I don't know if you've seen it.
No.
It's a great film. And essentially, they actually told the apartheid government they're doing a documentary, propaganda, and then when the government figured out that they were doing anti-apartheid propaganda, they kicked them all out. They sued a group of Americans. And now in this film, they follow this guy around, and they've got Miriam Makeba canting. But Miriam Makeba actually made her debut on this film. I don't know if she, you know, it launched a lot of people into fame. But they follow this actor around, and he enters a bunch of typical scenarios from, you know, becoming a laborer and so forth. And it's interesting how whenever things go badly for him, or whenever he gets fired or whatever it is, it's the moments where he's actually indulging or practicing his humanity. It's moments where he works in a mechanic shop and takes the car for a joyride, or he's in an apartment and he's listening to the music. It really showed how it was at the level of simply expressing like human nature. That was where the line was, where people were allowed to exist or not exist, which... And a place like Sophia Town illustrates the extremity of that, but also a rebellion against that, because, you know, that it was an outlet for all of that, which was suppressed otherwise, in a sense. And you get that from the stories that we were told about it.
I'm interested to hear the relationship, for example, of a settlement like Sophia Town and its ultimate abolishment, and the emergence of Soweto, Alexander, and maybe even Triumph. But I'm interested to hear your understanding and how we see the emergence of the black townships. Interestingly, though, in Alexander, that black people were allowed to own land, versus perhaps all of the other townships. Where black people weren't allowed to own land, and, you know, the 99-year lease situation. But interestingly, that in Alexander, black people were allowed to own land. Very, very a conversation that we still need to have, perhaps in other days. But how Sophia Town contributes to the existence, perhaps, of Soweto, Alexander, El Dorado Park, Noor Gesig, all of those other townships that become, shall we say, legacies of the apartheid policy of the Group Areas Act. I'm interested to hear from you, perhaps, how that emerges. But I want to take a quick call from Stembele in Protea North. And by the way, if you have any memories, if you were a resident of Sophia Town, what are your memories? If you are somebody who's heard stories about Sophia Town from your elders, your grandparents, give me a call. Talk to me about the dress, the music. What was the consciousness of Sophia Town as you had heard it? Stembele is in Protea North. Mu'Afrika.
Oh, Mu'Afrika.
Yes, sir.
Yo, Mu'Afrika. Talking about Sophia Town. So, like, I live stone's throws away from the late Ntate Don Matera.
Yes.
So Ntate Don Matera would tell me the stories how, like,
wow,
used to be a gangster, yeah, you know, and then nankadi barking a collection fee, like protection fee.
Oh, Don Matera used to take a protection fee.
He used to leave stone's throws away from me and that
really, eh? Yeah?
Yes. And he used to tell me...
Never said ever, Obradon.
He was a leader of a gangster, Khona Mole, by Sophia Town.
Yes.
In Praobs. And he used to tell me, like, lots of stories, like when the late Ntate... Hugh Masekela,
yes,
used to date and train man. Kimang?
Dolly Ratebe?
No.
Miriam Makeba?
Miriam Makeba,
right?
You know, and then I'm Kwajisa and all of that stuff.
Mang na Kwajisa mang.
Bra, doing na Kwajisa.
You must say it. Really?
You know.
So let me bring Isaac into the conversation. Let me quickly bring Isaac into the story. So Stembele tells, of course, of the stories that he would glean from the late great Don Matera.
Yes.
And how Don Matera was himself a bit of a gangster, and how Hugh Masekela used to be sort of intimidated. We call him Kwajisa in the townships. whenever he would visit Miriam Makeba, you know, in their romantic relationship. Very interesting that we have specific sort of ideas about certain personalities, Stembele. But they were human, they were real, yeah?
Very real, Praobs. And even the concept of graffiti.
Yes.
I remember during the removal days, there was a graffiti that was written called On Stagni. So
On Paula Eve. Yes.
Yes, Praob. So those are the memories that, like, I was actually left with, you know. And I want to write a book about Sophia Town.
You must. And here is Isaac, who would be, I suppose, available to share some of the information that they've put together on this virtual storytelling journey, yeah?
Oh, definitely, Praobs. Me, I'll be willing to share whatever story. And actually, there's a Jazz Appreciation Week coming up on the 28th at Africa Freedom Station. And it will be in Sophia Town, hosted by Steve Gwena, you know?
Nice.
And I think your guest would be, nice for him to come over and to collect more stories about Sophia Town.
Stembele in Protea North, thank you very much for your call. I mean, were those some of the stories that you gleaned from people who lived there? Isaac?
I'm smiling so broadly. Firstly, if you're in Joburg and you haven't visited the Africa Freedom Station, you must do so. It's an amazing, amazing space in Sophia Town. But we were speaking to one of the former residents in the interviews, and she was talking about Don Matera. They were classmates. They were in the same year. Can you believe it?
Yeah.
And she was saying the one thing that she remembers, because she remembers him before he, you know, he became gangster and so on. She remembers him always getting in trouble in English class, because he would always argue with the teachers. He would always say they were wrong, or this is how it is, or they should say it like that, or this is what the poem means, or whatever. That was his favorite subject. And she says the whole class would get so frustrated with this boy interrupting to correct the teacher and so on in English class. And I just thought, those kinds of stories and these characters which overlap, you know, constantly.
On Stagni, on Paula E. I'm interested perhaps to also talk a little bit about I'm fascinated by the evolution of Tsotsi Tao, which was quintessential to places such as Sophia Town, Marabastat, and all of those kinds. I'm totally fascinated with the hybridization of language, taking pieces of language from African vernacular, from Afrikaans, from English, from Dutch, from some of the Malay sounds, right? That created the Tsotsi Tao that is widely associated, obviously, with places such as Sophia Town. I want to take a call from Teddy Matera, huh? Pradon's son. Teddy, good evening, sir, and thank you so much. Wow, for calling us.
I couldn't help, man, to call because ek worry le pratsa me time.
On sweet if and your daddy, me bro.
Yeah, man. So nigina hana gore le nna ke batla
to contribute, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, no, just to say I'm a filmmaker also and very much deeply entrenched in fact we're doing a documentary on Don Matera at the moment.
Yep.
And I was just keenly interested, you know, from a professional point of view, from your expert who's there, how we might be able to get involved in helping to curate sure. that history, because it's really pertinent to what we're doing through Don Matera's Legacy Foundation, but also about recounting the history of Johannesburg and specifically Bosofia Town and Western Township where he grew up. I'll listen on the radio, but I just thought maybe I'd find out from your guest how we could maybe get in touch or be able to add to the legacy of Sophia Town through some of the history that we've curated over time. You know?
But I want to tell you a quick story. Circa 1992-93,
Yutopi
had a workshop in Kempton Park at one of the colleges there. I can't remember, right next to the train station then next to Van Riebeck Park in Kempton Park.
I was
one of the Leitikis that was in the group that was listening to some of the things that Don had to say about poetry, about expression, about history, about just consciousness. And I remember he said one thing to us as we were sitting there, we were a group of young people, you know, activist minded and, you know, wanting to change the world and all of those lovely things. And he comes out, he says, "You're going to discover as you grow older," you know, almost speaking like this voice of God almost. he says, "You guys are going to discover how much you're going to change. But what you need to understand is that you must never lose your ability to stay grounded and have the common touch." I even closed his eyes as he said that. I can remember it very clearly. Your dad didn't have a very good skin, by the way. I remember because I was sitting very close to. I remember sitting very close to him and watching his skin contort as he closed his eyes, saying that he says, "But never lose the common touch."
Kind of like he memorialized the moment.
And he says, "If you can't be relatable, if people can't see themselves in you, then you have failed. You have failed as poets." Because we were all writing, and he said, "Don't try to write poetry that is highfalutin with big words that nobody can relate. If you're going to write poetry, if you're going to write prose, if you're going to do any of that stuff, I'm seeing him right now, even as I say this, he closes his eyes. He says, "Don't lose the common touch." That's what a big memory that I have of Yutopi.
Beautiful, man. Thank you, bro.
Thank you, my good man. Brateri Matera. Oh, man, this is so cool. Isaac, sorry, I'm just having a bit of a moment there. Yeah, I mean, would that kind of thing work with you and somebody like Teddy?
Absolutely. I've been speaking to another Matera. I think maybe his sister. I'm not sure if they know, but it's for places like the Trevor Huddleston Center, the museum in Sophia Town. These places are so crucial because, you know, it's there. People can come together. If he's got the project for this and the documentary and so on, you know, everyone that's kind of has a stake in this place or is interested in this place, it's a central point where you can go, you can show what you're doing. And what's really amazing about the Trevor Huddleston Center is they are so very open to anything because they're an NGO at the end of the day, actually. The support comes from the community. And I think that's so special. You know, having worked with maybe some museums which are a little bit more gatekept in other places in the world and so on, the openness to just say, "Come to us. We just want to kind of house and disseminate, but we don't have the story. So come to us and let's see if we can work together and make something out of this." And that attitude from the museum. So please, like, go to the museum with this. That's exactly where things can happen and people can get in touch and so on. But that attitude has definitely helped this work. And other work, you know, go very far.
Yeah. One of the one of the things about history that I've come to know, and I've shared this with my audience, is that there is the history and there is the past, right?
Yeah.
What we write down, what we document through the oral history and our memories is the history. But then there's the past, what actually happened. Yeah. Because, you know, how we document it and how we speak about it is from a vantage point. It's a version. It's a version of the past. It's not so much the past, because the past is irretrievable. It happened. And it's unapologetically, objectively true, the past versus the history, the stories we tell about the past. And one of the things that strikes me about places such as Sophiatown, Marabastat, District 6 is the beautiful joy in the pain, and how there's a convergence of peoples who, by choice or by compulsion, were brought into these centers of urbanhood and had to develop a culture. And how that culture, that evolution is expressed in the language of that time, the Tsotsitaal, Zdakni and Spolai, the resistance, the tightening of the string of consciousness to produce the sound that was the beautiful Sophiatown, is what I always look at and think to myself, this is a history that has not been adequately told. How many of our people who came from the rurals, who became workers as a result of the migratory labor system, developed a new identity that was separate from their rural identity. The understanding and the appreciation of upward mobility in the modern sense versus what was happening perhaps in the rural areas. The settlement of that time, the cosmopolitanness of it all, the various different religions and the worldviews that were that represented the melting pot that was Sophiatown. That story, in the creation of the South African consciousness, hasn't been put together adequately. That story, yes, we feel it, we appreciate it, but that story hasn't been articulated hard enough. Does yours do that?
Look, I always feel like the fact that Mandela's on every note kind of proves to me how far we've gone with how deep we've actually engaged with this history. The fact that Sophiatown is kind of, in many people's minds, been reduced to these signifiers. Because yes, there's something there. What is that? That you just described, that thing that emerged, that joy within this very difficult thing that, you know, we did this interview with this one from Resin spoke to us. He had to leave school, you know, they were evicted when he was standard 5. And he looked me down and he said, he's tried figuring this out for years, but he cannot for the life of him remember the races or the languages of his classmates. He just cannot remember who was the Sotho, who was the Zulu, who was whatever it was. It just wasn't in the background of his mind. It wasn't something that he noted, you know? Yeah. And what is that? Why is that? There is something here which is in the character of South Africa. And I think as soon as you think you know what it is, you probably don't.
It slips away, yeah? Absolutely, yeah?
That's probably a good sign that you don't know that you've now lost the plot and you need to go a bit deeper.
Yeah.
And I really think that the only way to possibly try get closer to what that thing is to look at the mundane ways that people lived together and worked together and survived together and thrived together and how that happened. Because whatever we remember of Sophiatown, the big events, the big names and the big musicians, these were just like the bubbles that popped out of the surface of something bigger that's been brewing there every day. And I don't know what that was. I can't answer it. But I think focusing not on ideas or like, our preconceived notions of what this place meant, which we've already, and rather focusing on deeply looking in on, you know, someone who had a backyard garden and the kids would come in and take her peaches and no one would think about it. And that was everyday life. Something as mundane as that. And there are loads of those little stories. And thinking about that, why is that? How did that work? Why did they live like that? Why did the Indian woman cook for her black neighbor, even though, you know, they were of different religions and the one was very strictly Christian and very like against it. Like, why were people able to hold their beliefs but still
live in harmony?
Exactly. I mean, it sounds like a cliche, that living in harmony thing. But there's something about the South African character which was concentrated there. And we're hoping that with this exhibit and with this medium and with the way that we've portrayed it and the way we've worked with normal mundane stories and people's memories. Because if someone remembers something for 70 years, it's not mundane, right?
Sure.
And if you work with that, we're hoping that people can, in their own way, somehow get a bit closer to whatever that thing is, because it runs very deep, that's for sure.
It runs very, very deep, and I want to commend you guys for broaching the subject, because it can get very sensitive as we try to tell our version of it, because there are versions of it, right? Any moment in time has got various versions, and sometimes the battle comes when I want to say my version is the most correct and yours is not, and so forth. And I love the fact that you guys, in telling the story and the mediums that you use, have tried not to give a version. Have tried not to say this is the truth, because there are so many different vantage points from which you view the reality that was Sophia Town. Talk to me about the people that you interviewed, people that were residents of Sophia Town. Where do many of them live? When you look into their eyes and they talk about Sophia Town, what immediate emotion do you detect in the beginning?
Well, one thing that helped was that we went for the museum. So they all knew the museum. They all understood that this was contributing to the museum. So the trust barrier was already there. But I think, firstly, none of them still live in Sophia Town. And some of them, you know, it's nuanced. Like you said, we're not presenting an angle, but actually we are. We're presenting the former residents' angle. And because there are many of them, their different perspectives and ideas of this history start to overlap and so on. So, you know, there was definitely a sense of anger in one person in particular about it and in how they felt that it was never addressed properly after many years. And for another one who was quite a bit younger and had more childhood memories of Sophia Town, there was a real sense of joy and saying that, I'm just so happy to be here. I'm so happy to come. I love coming to the museum for events, because even driving in, I get a smile and I snake through the roads and remember where everything used to be. And, you know, that's the energy coming from the other person. And then from some of the other people we interviewed, there's just this, it's hard to describe, but what I would detect was, it's like they're here for business. They've got something to say. They thought about this for a long time, and they really want to express what this place meant to them. And it's not easy, but they're going to sit here and they're going to figure it out. And they did. And I think some of the former residents really dug very deep. So I think it's very mixed. As with all of this, there isn't a straight answer. They didn't all come with the same mindset and the same feelings. It was very, very mixed and nuanced. And I think that shouldn't be surprising, you know, based on how we look at this.
I think that the story of Sophia Town and many places such as Sophia Town is the story of South Africa, unhijacked by narratives. The South African story has been hijacked by ulterior motives, in my opinion. And the story of Sophia Town is the story of South Africa, the evolution, the development, the melting pot, that crucible of humanity being expressed. And Madumbe sends me a message now. He says, Sophia Town was a possibility of the future of unity in diversity, and became, and it became threatening to the ideology of separateness. And I would argue that the apartheid government was threatened by the possibility that Sophia Town and many places like it represented, because it was based on the idea of separateness, and the humanity argument was too scary for them to contemplate, because they had to push a white supremacist agenda, and the idea that different people from different areas, different backgrounds, could actually live together was problematic for that ideology, that way of thinking. So they had to obliterate it. Yeah? But I'm going to argue further and say that even the new dispensation, the government under the African National Congress and the legitimate democratic space, couldn't tell the story of Sophia Town because it threatened the narrative of the extraction from the narrative of apartheid. And so the story of Sophia Town is yet to be told, in the same way as the story of South Africa is yet to be told. You ask the question, what is that? That nebulous, untouchable thing is the story of South Africanness. And I'm hoping that the story that you tell is brave enough to go there. But it sounds like you are humble enough as a team that's telling this story to let the story tell itself.
Yes, because I think this ties back into what you were saying about story versus history. And I mean, the old adage is history is just a series of lies we've agreed on, right?
Yeah.
But the history is formed by what's convenient to the powers that be, usually. And that could include, that usually includes elements of the truth, which is what makes it so
cool. You know the story, Isaac, that the most powerful lie is the one that has 99% of the truth and just and just ignores that last little bit, yeah?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But if you go directly to the source, which we are still able to do, you know, and that was also why we felt that this work was important, because this isn't something we can do in 20 years from now. Because, like I said, the people we interviewed, some of them were in their 90s. This is, and they've never been interviewed before, which is crazy to me. But if whoever's going to tell the story of South Africa, it's going to be South Africans, like directly from their own experience. It's going to have to be. Otherwise, it's going to be a history which is convenient to some kind of agenda,
yeah.
You know. And if we can tell those stories concurrently and together and just show how complicated this place is. South Africa is such a complicated country. I mean, the deeper you go into it, you can keep looking at it forever.
I think it's both. It's both complex and complicated.
Yes.
And it's something that we should never shy away from. This is who we are, right? And I think we should never shy away from. Listen, we've almost run out of time. How do we get to experience your story? Where do we find it?
So this will be at the Trevor Huddleston Museum permanently. Now, the museum as an NGO is still looking for funding to get the equipment, which honestly is the cheap and easy part. Making the experience is the expensive part, which UJ is sponsoring. Mm. So that's been done. We're still working on it, but we've exhibited multiple times. But it will be at the museum permanently. And maybe this could be something that we could pull up, because currently they're just looking for the equipment, which would be a few VR headsets, and then that would form a permanent part. So the Trevor Huddleston Center will be the ultimate home for this, but then it's been exhibited at multiple different events, and will continue to be so as well.
Isaac, thank you very much for agreeing to talk to us, man. We really, really appreciate it, and congratulations on your work. And I really hope that many South Africans in the world over gets to go and see and hear and understand the South African story.